Calling State Affairs to order. It's 3:08 p.m. Thursday, April 18th, 2019. Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Wolf.
Here.
Representative Vance. Representative Shaw. Representative Ledoux. Representative Floyd.
Here.
Here, four members present. We do have a quorum to conduct business, at least temporarily, and Representative Fields will be in and out through the course of the day as he presents a bill in HES committee. We have three items in today's agenda. First hearing on HB 110. We'll have a bill presentation. We'll hold the bill. We'll take amendments as well as public testimony in the second hearing. It's my intention to move the bill on that second hearing, date TBD, but possibly next week. We have a second hearing on HB 115. We'll take public testimony. No amendments were submitted on HB 115. It's my intention to move that bill today. And we have HB 120, which is the third hearing, the second hearing on the CS that was adopted previously. We have one amendment. We'll consider that amendment. We'll take public testimony, and it's my intention to move that bill today. First bill, House Bill 110. Please come forward, Ms. Holland, and present the legislation.
For the record, my name is Megan Holland, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz, the bill's sponsor. I believe she will be back any minute to give opening remarks, but in the meantime, I can just go ahead and get started with our presentation. If you can follow along with me with the PowerPoint that we provided to the committee. I would like to note that I believe Marla Thompson, the director of the DMV, should be available online for those really specific questions in that area. And it's possible that Sandin Fisher from Legal might be joining us online later as well for any very specific probate questions that I might not have the capacity to answer.
And for your reference, Ms. Holland, Marla Thompson is online, but nobody from DOL yet, but I will let you know if that changes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Looking at slide two, the legislative history surrounding this bill. The Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act, this was an act endorsed by the Uniform Law Commission in 2009. It looks like Rep. Sponholz has joined us, so I'll turn it over to her.
My apologies, Chair Christ Tompkins. We were working on quorum in another committee.
No apologies required.
So I'm going to make an introduction, and then my my aide, Megan Holland, will do the sectional analysis on the bill. House Bill 110 continues in the spirit of the Uniform Real Property Transfer on Death Act that unanimously passed both bodies in 2014 and created the transfer on death deed for some real property. This bill, a similar bill or a preceding bill to HB 112, was introduced by the late Max Gruenberg, who's my predecessor, in 2016. It unanimously passed the House, but was not able to make it through the other body. His bill then, HB 273, extended the same concept of the transfer on death deed to titles for vehicles. But as I mentioned, it didn't pass. So it's sort of, it's wonderful here that we're in, you know, the late Max Gruenberg room while we're having a discussion about his concept. HB 112 is essentially identical to his legislation with one addition, and that is that we've expanded to include a transfer on death provision for boats in addition to vehicles. If it's passed, Alaskans will essentially be able to fill out a form at the DMV that would designate up to two beneficiaries for their car, vehicle, or their boat. After their death, the beneficiaries will simply provide proof of death to the DMV, fill out a form, pay a modest fee, and receive a new title in their name. It adds another tool in their tool belt for estate planners and for families who are trying to streamline the transfer of assets upon passing. This would be really important for somebody who needed a vehicle for work, needed to transfer it over. If a family-owned fishing business, you can imagine You need to be able to insure your boat. In order to have insurance on your boat, you need to have it be in your name. It would make this process easier for a family fishing business, for example. Transfer on death titles essentially streamline and simplify the estate planning process and help people avoid the costs associated with probate, so they can pass their assets to their beneficiaries more quickly, and they speed up the process of these transfers. And it's for that reason that the AARP, the Alaska Automobile Dealers Association, and the Alaska Commission on Aging support it. We've received no formal opposition to the bill. There also wasn't any opposition to Representative Gruensberg's bill in 2016, and so I hope you'll support this. And with that, I'm going to excuse myself to House Health and Social Services, which is missing me right now.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Ms. Holland, would this bill also apply to trailers or yes, that's the question, trailers.
Through the chair, Chair Christ Tompkins, it applies to vehicles which are titled through the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the DMV does issue titles for manufactured homes. These are homes that are...
And if I can interject, I should have clarified. Trailers is in sort of trailers that you would trailer behind a car, like a boat trailer or other kinds of wheeled trailers, as opposed to trailer homes.
Through the chair, I don't believe it does. Perhaps Ms. Thompson could clarify, but I don't believe it applies, because I don't think that unless the DMV issues titles for the trailer, they do? Yeah, maybe we should have her clarify.
Representative Wool before.
Yeah, I think some trailers do have license plates and therefore are registered, but Marla Thompson knows more than I do.
Director Thompson, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on record and speak to the trailer question?
Yes. Hi, thank you. My name is Marla Thompson. I'm the director of the DMV. And through the chair, anything that has a title would qualify under this bill, and that would include any type of trailer or a mobile home. Anything that already had a title, though, would have that option.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically what this bill does is just adds a few items to existing law: boats, trailers, anything with a title on transfer of death ability. Is that correct? So cars are already there. We're just adding boats, or help me out here.
through the chair, Representative Wool, there currently is not a mechanism provision under existing law for transfer on death titles for cars.
Okay.
This bill creates a transfer on death title for cars and boats. There are, if I can just have a second to pull it up, I can give you, just for context, a list of things that can already be transferred upon death outside of probate in the state of Alaska. But that includes, as of right now, deeds, bank accounts, brokerage accounts, and I believe there might be a few other items there, but that is what we can currently transfer upon death in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Story.
I basically wanted to comment that I see there's a fiscal note of $60,000 for the software system. That has been the complete amount that you think will be needed for this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Story, yes, I spoke with Ms. Thompson from the DMV about that fiscal note specifically, because the original bill in 2016, House Bill 273, did have a zero fiscal note. But since then, the DMV has completely redone their software. They have a new system, and because of this, there is a cost that they're going to need software engineers in order to implement it and create the new forms, because we're essentially creating two new types of titles under this legislation. So there is an associated cost, but you will notice that it is a one-time cost, and that after after the department has created the necessary forms and updated their software, that it'll be self-sustaining through fees.
Okay, so follow-up.
Follow-up.
So the department can just has that $60,000 flexibility within their budget to pay that, and then the time associated with will just be done by someone in the department?
Through the chair, Representative Story, my understanding of the, or my interpretation of the fiscal note, and perhaps if this isn't clear enough, Ms. Thompson can address it, is that they don't have that funding within their apartment. They can't absorb the costs, and that they do need the additional $60,000.
Thank you.
Is this a Uniform Law Commission recommended statute change?
Mr. Chair, no, it is not. The 2009 endorsed Uniform Law Commission Act, the URPDDA for short, Uniform Real Property Transfer and Death Act, that created a transfer and death deed. It did not include boats and vehicles, although I have to pull up the number really quick, but this is a trend that we're seeing in other states. 11 other states have implemented transfer on death titles for vehicles and 7 for boats. So the ULC hasn't put their stamp of approval on it, but as the bill sponsor previously stated, this is sort of following in that spirit of finding, you know, more assets, more forms of personal property that we can transfer outside of the process of probate in order to, you know, pass along more of that value to our beneficiaries.
So in summary, Ms. Holland, we passed the Uniform Law Commission, recommended statute change. All was fine and well. Like, oh, we're Alaska, we've got a lot of boats here. It'd be really helpful to add on and elaborate and basically expand that concept to sort of annex these assets. Is that a fair summary?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Okay. Another question, Section 1. I'm a little bit hazy. I remember the legislation the legislature passed 1 or 2 years ago requiring titling for boats and registration, and I can't remember exactly what it did. And I'm seeing in the PowerPoint that you prepared, I'm not sure which page of the PowerPoint because there aren't page numbers, but the slide that includes the sectional analysis. Which notes that boats in Alaska are exempt from the title requirement AS 0525055 if they're less than 24 feet long. And I think my question is, does this legislation, what's the significance of noting that in the sectional analysis?
Through the chair, I was wanting to show members which boats are required to be issued titles through the DMV, and boats that are less than 24 feet long are exempt from that provision. Obviously, a lot of people's boats, your average Joe's boat, is probably going to be less than 24 feet long. And, you know, the intent of this legislation is clearly to allow people to transfer those boats along. So that was a concern that came up early on in our research. There is a provision under, and I could cite the statute for you, under Title V, which allows individuals who have boats that are less than 24 feet long to apply for a title if they wish. So although they are exempted from the requirement, it's permissible for them to apply for a title, and so therefore they could also take advantage of a transfer and death title. I hope that addresses your question.
Yeah, you actually went exactly where I was wondering. Thank you.
Question?
Representative Story.
Where is that information shared with the public, that if your boat is under 24 feet long, you can still do this? How will they know?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I think that would be a great question for Ms. Thompson online. I'm unaware.
Director Thompson, can you put yourself on record and speak to Representative Story's question?
Yes. Hi, this is Marla Thompson again with the director of the DMV. And so the titling of the boats is a brand new process. that we that just started January of this year, and boats that are 25 feet and above are required for the title if they're not documented somewhere else. And but anybody can go ahead and title a boat. And so what we would do is we just went in and refreshed our website with all of this information on titling. We would add a separate section in there and informing anybody who's on our website about the options to do this. And since like anybody, it's optional, I think it will work fine.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thompson, so if a boat is titled, is that the same as when they have sort of a bunch of numbers on the bow of the boat? Is that inclusive of a title?
Through the chair, no, I think what you're might be mentioning would be either the HIN number that's on it, or that might be the U.S. Coast Guard documented number, which would be on the boat. The title is actually going to be very similar to what a title for a vehicle looks like. It basically says State of Alaska, and it's a boat title, and it does have a title number, but it wouldn't be a number that's on your actual boat.
Follow up. So if a boat is titled, it wouldn't necessarily have like a license plate type, say that a trailer might have, or a motorcycle or something like that.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? I think we're good. Thank you, Ms. Holland. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for Monday, 5 o'clock, this coming Monday, with the intention of, I think, re-noticing this bill for Tuesday. And we can take it from there. Representative Story, do you have an after-the-fact question?
I do. I'm sorry, because you did go over this with me that it had a $60,000 fiscal note with it, but then the next sentence says it's based on the $600 programming hours at a cost of $100 per hour, and that is in kind since that's not listed here?
Through the chair, Representative Story, Mr. Chairman, perhaps maybe Ms. Thompson could address the fiscal note.
Yeah, absolutely. Director Thompson, can you put yourself on record and speak to Representative Story's question about the fiscal note?
Yes. Hi, this is Marla Thompson again with the DMV, the director of the DMV. And through the chair, the fiscal note is really just programming time on our IT staff or any contractor that we might have to bring in to do the actual work. And I feel based off of what we just did for the titles of the boats, this is very similar to the amount of work that was required to create a title. This is a different type of title for vehicles and for boats. And so there's work to be done. Prior to this, we were on an older system, which was the mainframe. And I was not around for that fiscal note, but this one is really based on what needs to be done on the backside. This doesn't have any training hours or anything that is not related to actual IT work.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
So I'm going to run with this a little bit on the subject of the fiscal note. Again, looking at the presentation, the slide deck, it notes that one would pay a small fee for a transfer on death title. Ms. Holland, how much would the fee be?
Mr. Chair, that would be determined by the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Okay. And I'm just pulling up the fiscal note here. Director Thompson, given that there would be a fee presumably determined by regulation, why does the fiscal note not reflect any revenue in future years reflecting that fee?
So this is Marla Thompson, the director. And the fee, the $15, is what we currently charge for a title fee. And since there was no mention of a different fee, I didn't add anything different. It would be the same fee that we charge for vehicle transfers of title, new title, duplicate titles, it would just be the same $15.
I think I'm a little confused. Could you sort of restate the latter half of that answer? It's the same fee that somebody. Sorry, could you just say that once more for my sake, Ms. Thompson?
Correct. Sure, no problem. So the current price for a title is $15 at the DMV. So if you came in to title your boat, it's $15. If you came in to title your vehicle, it'd be $15. This is just a process change, a different type of title, so it would still be the same $15. And it didn't seem like there would be more titles. It's the same number of vehicles. It's just a different type. So you either have A, B, or C, you know, a different type of title choice.
Thank you. So there's no marginal or additional fee that is paid for somebody to get a TOD title. It's just a different kind of title. Okay. I think I'm clear. Any other questions, Representative Story or Representative Wohl? Okay, now I think we're good. Thank you, Ms. Holland, for coming in.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Great. That takes us to House Bill 115 from Representative Tuck and Mike Mason, his staff. Welcome, Mr. Mason. This is the second hearing. As I stated earlier, it's my intention to take public testimony such that there is public testimony, and there is public testimony, as well as any committee for follow-up committee questions. Any reintroductory comments, Mr. Mason?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. He apologizes for not being able to be here today. This is a very simple bill that you heard, I think a week ago or so, and nothing really to add other than I just wanted to say that I had the opportunity to present this bill to the Alaska Commission on Aging earlier today, this morning, and they were very receptive, and I got a call a couple of hours ago that they were going to endorse this bill. So you should be getting some information early next week from them, basically endorsing this piece of legislation, which essentially puts in place a permanent absentee voting system in the state of Alaska, and I can answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Representative Story or Wohl? There are no questions.
Comment.
Is it a comment on the bill as a whole?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's maybe save that for after public testimony. At this point, I'm going to open public testimony. Evan Anderson in Anchorage, please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hi, thanks so much. My name is Evan Anderson. I'm the Civic Engagement Manager for the Alaska Center Education Fund, and I'd like to thank committee co-chairs Fields and Craig Tompkins for hearing this legislation today, and all the members of the committee for hearing public testimony today. I'm a 5-year resident of South Central Alaska and staff for the Alaska Center Education Fund, where we believe that our democracy here in the state of Alaska is strongest when we have full participation from across the electorate. When we design our elections in ways that allow every eligible Alaskan's voice to be heard, we can achieve more equitable decisions for all Alaskans. I'd like to applaud Representative Tuck for his leadership in this pro-voting reform. I think, you know, I've already heard members of the committee say that this is, you know, a common sense piece of legislation so that we can have permanent absentee voting for people who apply for their ballots every year. This is a major win for folks like students, you know, young people across the board, people of varying abilities, older folks, anybody who applies for that absentee ballot in a given year. The chances are, you know, higher that they're going to vote again if that ballot comes automatically, and except if it, you know, were to be returned back to be undeliverable or if that person stops voting. So there's 11 states that already have this reform. Alaska has proven itself to be a leader across the nation in common sense voting reforms in the past. We stand on the shoulders of civil rights heroes here in Alaska, such as Elizabeth Brachovich,
who helped pass the first in the nation Anti-Discrimination Act in 1945. This might seem like a minor change, but I believe that permanent absentee voting would actually be a major win for accessibility to our elections for communities across the state. Thanks again so much for your time, and I look forward to seeing continued action on House Bill 115.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony. I'm seeing no questions. Moving next in the queue, Vary De Suvero in Anchorage, please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hello to the committee. My name is Vary De Suvero, and I am the director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. The Alaska Public Interest Research Group is an organization focused primarily on protecting consumers and ensuring that there is the best possible governance in the state that makes an equitable and just state for everyone. And I think permanent absentee voting is something that we really support because every American has the fundamental right to vote and have that vote counted. And, you know, we're in a day and age where we can use computers and smartphones to do everything from paying our utility bills to reading the day's headlines. And so there's no reason that signing up to receive a ballot shouldn't be easy and accurate and accessible. I think permanent absentee voting would be a really incredible step in the direction towards making sure that Alaska's electorate receives the best voting access possible. And while we would be a leader, this isn't without precedent. You know, there are 8 states as well as Washington, D.C., that maintain another permanent absentee ballot list. And so this is, you know, it expands access. It makes voices easier. It provides an easier path for voices to be heard in the state. And so AFPERG, my organization, is very in favor of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Moving, that exhausts online testimony. Is there anybody in the room to testify on House Bill 115? Seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony at this time. This takes us to committee comment or discussion. Representative Story?
Yes, I wanted to say that I appreciated getting the email from Barbara A. Jones, the Anchorage Municipal Clerk, about how to make sure that there is a security plan for getting a mail-in vote ballot and then someone not showing up at the polls, maybe voting twice. I believe there were some questions about that from members of the committee the last time. How do we make sure someone doesn't vote twice? And so I read this, and that was good, but it made me wonder, is this in place in other parts of the state?
I believe that we have the Division of Elections director online who might be able to provide, or I think she might be in the room, actually. She might be able to provide some additional insight, but I do know there are protections in place currently to prevent double voting.
Director Funumiai, would you be available?
Hi, good afternoon. Gail Funumiai, Director, Division of Elections. Through the Chair, Representative Story, your question was about securing and ensuring duplicate voting did not take place.
Yeah, Anchorage sent an email, the clerk did, about how they have security measures in place. They've somehow coded a ballot that goes home, and so then if someone showed up at the polls, they would know the ballot was double. And I was just wondering if this happens across the state or unique to Anchorage.
Well, since Anchorage, through the chair, Representative Story, since Anchorage is an all-by-mail system, their security measures would be a little bit different. The state of Alaska would still need to be producing precinct registers, and those precinct registers would be marked such applied for by-mail ballot or applied for absentee ballot. And if someone was to show up and vote at the polls and insist on voting, we would require them to vote a question ballot. That would be the division's policy to ensure that if they already voted their by-mail ballot and sent it in, that there would not be duplicate voting going on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just just on that same topic, because I brought this up at the, I think, at the last meeting, which was, if I get the ballot mailed every year, because you can just be on automatic, and then I happen to be driving by the polling place, and maybe I didn't check my mail or what have you, you're saying that there'll be a mark next to my name saying that I requested a mail ballot, which may be a recurring action, then my ballot that I give them would be sort of set aside and made sure that now they have to see if my other ballot came. How would that work? Like, they'd have to go through the pile of mail-in ballots and look for my name, and then, yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, in order to ensure that there isn't duplicate voting going on when people are voting by mail or voting early, there needs to be a notation made in the precinct register to notify the election worker that this person has already voted. And we would then request them to vote a question ballot. And all ballots that are come back to the regional offices are logged and reviewed and then entered into our voter registration system. And so there would be a method to determine if your by-mail ballot happened to come in and you also voted a question ballot, your question ballot would not be counted if your by-mail ballot was received before the question ballot.
Hello. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what if I lived in a home where a mail-in ballot, let's say I get a mail-in ballot, but I'm out that week, and someone else in my household grabs that ballot and wants to mail it in. Is the ballot identified with a marker that it's for me or from me when I mail it in? It has my name on it somewhere, right?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, you would right now, and with the way the division would continue, is a witness is required and an identifier of the voter is required, as well as the voter's signature. So those three items have to be on the back of the by-mail envelope in order for it to meet through the first level of review to be considered to be counted.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't mean to really get into the mechanics of how mail voting goes, but since you're here and since we're talking about mail-in voting, so a marker's put on that envelope that it's from a certain individual. And only that individual can vote on that ballot. So if I request them from my house, and let's say I'm out of town, and my wife says, oh, here's a ballot, I'll just mail in this one, then I don't have to go to the polls. Does it work like that, or is it individually identified?
The ballot, through the chair, Representative Wohl, the ballot mailed to a voter is mailed to that specific individual, and only that individual, since they requested the by-mail ballot, is allowed by law to vote and return that ballot.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Committee comment on House Bill 115.
I've enjoyed all the background information that was presented with it. It was interesting to see what happened and how Colorado's getting a 60% return rate in voting. That this measure helped, and I noticed in the paperwork that it had Alaska at 18% voting. So, and I'm sure it varies, you know, at different places. This must be an overall average for our state that they got. But I appreciate the background information, and I think this is a good measure.
Thank you, Representative Story. Get
Thank
on
you,
the bandwagon,
Mr.
Representative.
I like it too. I think it's sort of a step towards mail. I personally don't want to have only mail voting, but M-A-I-L voting, but I do like the option, so if it gets more people to vote, that's great. Who knows, maybe I'll do it one day.
Great, thank you. I'd like to echo that. I think it's a great bill, simple, straightforward. And we're going to move it today. I'm going to stack all the motions for this committee at the very end of the committee when we have four members present in order to have a quorum. So, Mr. Mason, you can hang around if you want, but I promise this bill will move. And that takes us to the third item on today's agenda, House Bill 20, and same proviso. So I'd like to hold off on adopting the amendment. I want to open it up if there are remaining questions from members present for the sponsor, with Representative Tarr here, work through public testimony, then consider and presumably pass the amendment and move House Bill 20 as well as House Bill 115 when Representative Fields is able to rejoin us. Welcome back, Representative Tarr and Ms. Andrews, to the committee. Any reintroductory remarks, as it were?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Garantar from Anchorage and joined with
Stephanie Andrews, staff to Representative Tarr.
Thank you for the opportunity to be before you again today. And we do have a couple comments just related to the amendment, so we could save those that way to just be efficient with the time.
You know, I think we could just dive in now. I mean, just to present the amendment. And
okay.
I've spoken with Representative Fields about the amendment, so I feel confident he'll be apprised.
Okay. So the sections of the bill related to the rape kits, which include the year timeline, the sending of the kits within 30 days, and the victim notification, and the update to the audit report. We've sort of set that aside. That's been very well vetted. Everybody's on board. What we had added were a couple other pieces, if you recall from the first hearing, related to sexual assault in the second degree, and then the definition of consent. Both of those, you know, needed some more work. So the consent piece came out, and I just wanted to announce in this committee that next Tuesday we're having sort of a workshop session at lunchtime to talk about that, and we'll be sure to come around to offices. But I had said before, we're really excited about this. It's going to be pretty transformational, because of course what's foundational to trying any of these charges is, you know, the laws and the definitions, right? So that piece is going to be really big. So the other piece on defining sexual assault in the second degree, and I think Ms. Olson from STAR is going to speak to this in her testimony, but as it is described to me, what happens is, because the definition of without consent involves the use of force, that when there are sexual assaults that involve a incapacitated person, if jurors don't see evidence of force, then they often don't perceive it as a sexual assault. And so the two kind of are interrelated in that sense. And so this change is to make it more clear in those circumstances, so that you know, basically it doesn't sort of provide this little loophole where someone can commit a sexual assault, but because there's no evidence via like a bruise or other physical markings, because the person was incapacitated, then, you know, the jury is looking at that as if it didn't actually occur, right? That it doesn't meet that definition for force. So this will clean that up. And we also have Mr. Skidmore, who's going to be on the line. And we had talked about in the earlier meeting just the different standards for mental state. And the default mental state is reckless disregard. And so it's sort of as it's been described, it's, you know, the reasonable person standard, and then recklessly disregarding some, you know, this behavior. Or so the way the amendment cleans that up is just by removing a couple of the words, so it isn't sort of so awkwardly worded as it was sort of described as working it through. So when we adopt the amendment, I think you'll be able to see, but it's basically, instead of sort of putting these parameters around it, it's just establishing that, you know, when the individual who commits the crime knows the other person is incapacitated, then it's a sexual assault. So it's not saying in the language that there also has to be reckless disregard, because the default is reckless disregard. So it was sort of redundant, as it was explained to us by Department of Law, and their recommendation was to just remove it, and that would be cleaner. What has happened since our last meeting is there are other crime bills going through and other bills dealing with sexual assault, and so this was vetted through another committee process, and this was the settled upon clearer language to adopt.
Which committee was that, or what piece of legislation?
Senate Judiciary for Senate Bill 35, which was one of the governor's bills, but through their committee process, they've been amending and considering some other items, so this conversation was happening there too. So I feel good about it. We've vetted it with the advocates as well as with Department of Law, and sort of walk through the scenarios of why this will be cleaner. And of course, again, the whole purpose here is, you know, you want the wording clear enough so then when it comes time for a jury, right, to, you know, be in the position of this criminal case and evaluating whether a crime has taken place, you know, you want the words that they're going to read to be as clear as possible so they understand how to evaluate that individual's behavior relative to the law.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Wool.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know what I'm looking at. I have the amendment, but you used the word incapacitated. This also uses the expression mentally incapable. Are these temporary states or permanent states? Or is mentally incapable someone who's permanently mentally incapable, or is it someone who got really drunk, I guess? Same with incapacitated. I don't know technically what those words mean.
Through the chair to Representative Wool, I think both. It could be a person, you know, more often in these sexual assault cases, I think you're seeing people who are incapacitated via, you know, substance use. But I think it could also apply to someone who otherwise had a developmental delay or something, so that the person should have known they were mentally incapable of providing consent in the context of without consent.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess that what if both people are incapacitated through drugs and alcohol? So, I mean, obviously, if one person's incapacitated, one person takes advantage of it. We don't want that, and that's what you're addressing here. What if both people get extremely inebriated or otherwise intoxicated? And I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what judges and juries mm-hmm. are for. So does incapacitation go towards just the victim, or I guess maybe that's a legal question, but.
Well, through the chair to Representative Wool, it depends on who the, you know, the defendant is in that particular case. I think, you know, what makes these human behavior situations so complicated is that, you know, there could be behavior on both sides of any circumstance that are challenged. Yeah.
Thank you.
Further questions on the amendment? All right. And any questions on the bill as a whole for either of you, Representative Story or Wool? Seeing none, at this point I'm going to transition to public testimony and open public testimony. We have a number of people online. We'll start out of state with Katie Botts in Minnesota. Ms. Botts, please put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the House State Affairs Committee. My name is Katie Botts. I do live in Keno, but I'm currently in Minnesota due to work purposes. I am in support of House Bill 20. Please don't water down the bill to allow perpetrators to continue to get a slap on the hand. Keep the bill strong yet stable to allow all Alaskans across the state to understand and able to abide by it. The phrase without consent is being analyzed more difficulty than should be. And regarding to the 1 year period, please cut it down to 1 to 6 months. When I had it done, it was less than a month back in 1990s. How much more does a victim need to be re-victimized? As legislators, you are literally messing with people's lives. I don't understand why money has to be involved in everything in regarding to these kids. How many times this state continues to fail, this state continues to fail victims of sexual abuse by viewing us as nothing more than a statistic on paper to be thrown into the trash can and be lit on fire. Please don't sit on such a bill that proves and prove to Alaskan victims that we do have a value as a human being. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boats, for your testimony. Moving online in some kind of geographic sequence, Carissa Callahan, please put yourself on record, state your name and affiliation, and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hi, yeah, my name is Carissa Callahan. I'm actually originally from Montana, but I currently live in Pasadena, California for work as well. So I come from an area that is also high in rape and sexual assault, and I myself am an assault survivor, it is incredibly important for having recovered from that to have had the support of my community and the people around me. But in the absence of that, in the absence of speedy collection of rape test kits, sometimes some of that justice is not possible, and that compensation for the victim in terms of justice, and I'm getting emotional. Please, I am voicing my support for HB 20. This is needed for the women, and this is needed for the communities to bring healing. I hope that you push it through. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Callahan, for your testimony. Next online, Carmen Lowry with ANDVSA here in Juneau. Please put yourself on record, state your name and affiliation, and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Carmen Lowry, and I serve as the executive director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We are a membership-based organization that's comprised of a total of 24 community-based organizations providing services to victims, survivors, and their families. I want to thank the committee for offering this opportunity to testify. The network is in full support for HB 20. I just want to first start off by saying how much we appreciate Representative Tarr's leadership on addressing sexual assault kit processes. She has done that from a survivor-centered approach. She's been instrumental in supporting Alaska to address issues of backlogged kits. She also has a very well-informed approach. As mentioned earlier, advocates have been able to weigh in. It's been vetted through national policy. This bill represents very solid, trauma-informed processes. And in particular, I want to point out that what makes it a trauma-informed process, this notion that when the time frame, victims who have undergo a forensic exam and have a kit put together, they need to know what is the time frame. They don't need to have parts of themselves going into the crime lab and not understand when will they hear something. That we have now articulated that after, within 1 year, that the crime lab will process the kit, that within 2 weeks of being processed, law enforcement will contact a survivor and let them know that their kit's been tested. This is critical information. This is critical to facilitate healing. Another final point I want to make around what makes this such a strong survivor center and trauma-informed is that when the report comes out to the legislature, not only will you all know how many kits have not been tested, how many have been tested, but you will know the reasons that kits have not been tested. And why that's so important? Because every kit represents a victim. And victims deserve, survivors deserve to know what is going on with their information, with their experience. So I just want to say we're very supportive. We're thankful that we were able to participate in this process, and we encourage the committee's favorable consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sari, for your testimony. Carly Wells in Fairbanks, please put yourself on record, state your affiliation, if any, and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you. My name is Carly Wells, and I work with sexual assault victims in Fairbanks, Alaska. I cannot stress enough how powerful and necessary it is to pass HB 20. As you know, Alaska is the highest in the nation for sexual assault, and we're in the middle of an epidemic. The healing journey for victims is long and painful and difficult, so passing this would give some level of dignity back to them, for them to know a time frame on when their kit would be tested, not just afraid it's sitting somewhere on a shelf with no one caring to move it forward. Also, having a year time frame would give the victim some peace of mind to know they won't be getting a call 4 or 5 years or more down the road with results. This does happen that far out, and to many victims nationwide, that can seriously derail them in their journey. Passing this bill does not bring excess costs in getting the kids tested and is showing how much we as a state care about victims and getting justice for them in a reasonable amount of time. For the sake of the victims, give them back some dignity, some sense of security and knowing, because the rape itself strips them of all of that. As someone who hears their stories day in and day out, I can tell you this bill is not just necessary, but incredibly needed in our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wells, for your testimony. Lee Bolin in Dillingham, please state your name and affiliation and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hi, my name is Lee Bolin. I'm the president of the National Association of Social Workers Alaska chapter, and I also manage the Child Advocacy Center that serves Bristol Bay. I want to thank Representative Tarr for her leadership in addressing sexual assault kit processes and also having a trauma-informed approach. We appreciate that this book clearly stipulates a time frame and also outlines the time frames as well as reporting from law enforcement agencies. One comment that I have about this, I'm in full support of this, but regarding Section 11, this is the very, very end, it states that a sexual assault examination kit is ineligible for testing if the enforcement agency or State Department finds that the kit was improperly collected, is not necessary to identify the perpetrator of the crime, or was collected from a person who does not wish to proceed. It's my understanding that children are not allowed to do anonymous kits or say they don't want to proceed. So I feel it's important that we outline that in here. With adult kits, they can do anonymous kits or they can say that they do not wish to proceed with the criminal charges. But when it comes to a sexual assault of a minor, I don't believe that that is an option. So I really would like that to just be ironed out. But otherwise, I'm in full support of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bolin, for your testimony. Keely Olson in Anchorage, please put yourself on record, present your affiliation and your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you, co-chair. I am very thankful to be able to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Keely Olson. I'm the executive director of STAR, or Standing Together Against Rape in Anchorage. I have been very vocal about this bill and having supported it in past committee hearings. I want to thank the committee for allowing the testimony to come forward and for stating that you're very confident that this bill will be moving forward today. I did want to just comment regarding the language referencing the mental state, that removing that does make everything clearer. It changes, you know, to a default of acting recklessly or with reckless disregard. This is important because it will make it more difficult for an offender to claim that, you know, one didn't know that the victim was incapacitated. And it gives more tools to the prosecution, more tools to a sitting jury to evaluate the evidence. Would a reasonable person come to the conclusion that, well, you should have known? I would know. Anyone looking at the evidence might know. But that's not what the current standard is. So this change will make that a lot clearer for sitting jurors in criminal trials, and I think will yield better outcomes than the state having to prove what defendant claims to have known or not known. Let the evidence speak for itself and let the jury decide. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, for your testimony. Angela Trujilloy, apologies if I mispronounced
Trujillo.
Oh, thank you. It was an orthographic mishap here. Please put yourself on record, state your affiliation, if any, and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Hi, I am Angelia Trujillo. I am a forensic nurse examiner and have been for approximately 20 years, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I wanted to call in and speak also to this this bill, and I agree with prior testimony about first off child kits and having the verbiage clarify that that they are not anonymous, and don't have that option, and that just needs to be clarified in the bill. I agree. I also agree with the updated verbiage related to the offender's mental state and their knowledge of victim incapacitation. I do believe that this will strengthen the ability of the trier of fact to come to a more judicial accounting for victims who come forward. As a prior nurse examiner, I've seen many cases where victims have not been able to go forward, or they have not been tested within a timely manner, and this puts victims in a state of not knowing where they're going to go, and then finding themselves sometimes 12 and 15 years later where they're actually having to go forward and revisit the trauma yet again. So I agree and wholeheartedly hope that you pass House Bill 20. And thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody in the room to testify in House Bill 20? Please come forward.
Chair Kreis Tompkins and members of the committee, my name is Patty Owen. I live in Juneau. I'm here representing the Alaska Public Health Association, and we're a membership organization of public health professionals and community members across the state, about 150 of us, that are dedicated to improving the health and wellness of Alaskans. We know that domestic violence and sexual assault is a primary public health issue in Alaska, and it's one of our priority areas, and we support HB 20. Happy to support it and thank Representative Tarr for her leadership. We do, as the Public Health Association, promote and advocate and respond to the public health challenge and support efforts, policies, and programming that are embraced by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. We believe that this bill promises to address the backlog of sexual assault kits and process the kits in a timely manner. We agree with the changes that have been outlined, and that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that written testimony?
No. It could be.
That's quite all right. Thank you. Next in line. And while you're coming up, for anybody online who testified from pre-written testimony, and I didn't gather that might have been the case, but in case it was, it's very helpful for House records to have that as reference, and we would be obliged and grateful if you could email that written testimony to hsta@akledge.gov, hsta, hemlock, spruce, tongass, alder @akledge.gov. And please go ahead, put yourself on record and present your testimony in 2 or less minutes.
Thank you. My name is Diane Castro. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We're located here in Juneau. We are a council of 9 members plus a staff that works for the council. All 9 members of the council are appointed by the governor or are in statute as to the state departments that represent the council. So on the council, just so you know, and I want to frame this as to why we're not necessarily supporting the bill, but supporting the concept. So the council includes the Department of Corrections, the Department of Public Safety, Education, Health and Social Services, and the Department of Law. In addition, we have 4 public members. So we meet quarterly. So it's very difficult to, when you only meet quarterly, to come out in full support for a bill, because as this bill is a perfect example, there are amendments that occur, and so the council itself is not willing to take a stand until they know a bill's solid. But we did meet in March. We went through all of the current bills that relate to sexual assault and domestic violence and agreed on concepts, and we definitely support the concept of this bill. We believe that the issue of revising the language. The new amendment is will be a good step forward. We also believe very strongly that having strong testing and having consistent and certain consistency and certainty about testing when it's going to happen will also increase the number of women and men who are victims to come forward and report. I think a lot of our lack of reporting is because victims feel that nothing is going to happen. So having more consistency and timeliness in that process is going to be a good thing. So while I can't give full support to HB 20 from the Council on Domestic Violence, I can say that we support the concept. We support all of the current legislation that is moving us in a very positive direction to begin eliminating and hopefully ending at some point domestic and sexual violence in Alaska. As we all know, it is high, the rates are high, and this is something that we need to tackle together, and that I believe we can, and this bill takes us one step forward in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Casto. Full conceptual support.
Full conceptual
support. Any questions or at this point comments from committee members, Representative Story or Wohl?
No, not right now. I heard a lot about it, and I think it's a good bill, and we've heard from it last year, and so looking forward to moving along.
Thank you. Well, Representative Story?
Yeah. Under Section 4, the third part, it says after 2 weeks, a reasonable effort will be made to notify the victim that testing occurred. Has anyone talked about what reasonable effort, what that would mean?
Do you see that was Section 4, Representative Story?
Yes, Section 4, and I believe it says the agency, so it must be public safety.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Tarr.
I appreciate the opportunity to address that. This is something we have worked closely with law enforcement and troopers on. And the reason it says reasonable is we wanted to allow flexibility because of the many different forms of communication and the just differences geographically in the state. So, you know, in some circumstances, maybe a text message would be preferred or a phone call would be preferred, or maybe someone wants something by mail. But we wanted to allow law enforcement to individualize that experience so that they could, you know, make sure they didn't mail something, for example, to a location if the person didn't want that information to be known to the people they live with and instead could choose to receive a phone call.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Representative Story.
Yeah, and I just assume someone will be calling till they get someone or reaching out until they will. And then I wanted to comment, I know one of the earlier public testifiers had talked about trying to make it sooner than 1 year, thinking that's a long time, and we talked about that before, and if my memory serves me right, it was about $600,000 to speed up the time.
Through the chair to Representative Story, it was about $600,000, but that also included funding for the database that's about $100,000, and in priority from folks, you know, in the advocate world and that we've been working with, if available funding, you know, if there's funds available, the first priority is definitely to use any dollars available to shorten the timeline. So that would be the first priority. And then the second priority would be the database because that has an ongoing cost for it. So that portion of it is about $440,000. So if we wanted to have this bill have a six-month deadline, it would be about a $440,000 fiscal note addition. And I've brought that up in a couple of different ways to see if there would be support. And I was thinking this bill goes next to the Finance Committee, that would be the place to really sort of finalize that decision, whether the Finance Committee would then, you know, really evaluate among other public safety bills that might also be headed that way, if there are going to be additional funds spent this year, how to prioritize those. I am all for a 6 month. And we have a letter of support from an organization we've worked with, the Joyful Heart Foundation. They want states to get to 30 days, really, is where they would like to go. But I will say we started out at about 18 months, so we are making progress, and I think we have to keep pushing on that to really get there. And I've just been thinking about this a lot lately, having just attended, last week was the National Crime Victims Week, and I attended a banquet in Anchorage, and families and individuals here in sexual assault cases are no different. I think when we think about justice, we have some more work to do, because it's, you know, the event that happens, but then how long does someone have to interact with the judicial system to have that resolved? 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 years. It makes me question in my mind if we truly are, you know, allowing those people to have the justice that they deserve, because that's just got to be so difficult to have to go through it for so long. So I just say I hope we can move towards a place, and I just don't know that there's the will of the legislature to go to the six-month deadline this year.
Representative Story.
I appreciate that you're going to put that forward and seek to see if there can be that will. I think this is, right now in the state of Alaska, we're really trying to come to grips with the extent of the problem that we have. And it's a good time to really make aware of efforts to move it along more quickly. But thank you very much for this bill.
Thank you, Representative. And I would just say one of the things we've learned through doing some of this work is that, you know, unfortunately, some individuals are serial sexual assaulters. And, you know, when it takes a long, long time for that individual to be, you know, tried for that original crime. I mean, we have the case of the individual from Anchorage. When they finally were able to get his DNA in 2014, they were able to link him back to crimes that went back to 2001. So when we don't move quickly, you know, we allow dangerous people to be out in our communities potentially committing more crimes. And I don't say that to be dramatic. It's just what the data and the evidence from other cases tells us. So it motivates me to think, you know, if we really want to achieve safety, you know, the more quickly we can do this, the more we can address the true people who are dangerous in our communities and make it safer for everyone else.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Further questions or comments? Welcome, Representative Fields, and being at minimum full strength to take committee action, would entertain a motion to adopt Amendment 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 1, which is Work Order G.1.
Seeing and hearing no objection, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. At this time, I'll entertain a motion to move House Bill 20 from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 20, version 31-LS0253/G as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 20 moves from committee. Thank you, Representative Tarr. And at this time, I'll entertain a motion to move House Bill 115.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version of 31-LS0213/A of HB 115 with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 115 moves from committee. It's 4:16. I want to note three amendment deadlines for next week, all Monday, 5 o'clock. We have an amendment deadline for House Bill 82, the non-discrimination bill from Representative Josephson, House Bill 31, the $5.5 billion transfer from earnings reserve account to the principal of the permanent fund from myself, and also the aforementioned amendment deadline for House Bill 110 from Representative Sponholz. We'll be back next Tuesday, and we are adjourned.